Chapter 7. The word lousy, like the word volunteer, the word fire, the word department, and many other words found in dictionaries and other important documents, has a number of different definitions depending on the exact circumstances in which it is used. There is the common definition of the word lousy, meaning bad, and this definition of lousy has described many things in my history of the Baudelaire orphans, from the sinister smells of Lousy Lane, along which the children travelled long ago, to their lousy journey up and down the Mortmain Mountains in search of the VFD headquarters. There is the medical definition of the word lousy, meaning infested with lice, and this definition of lousy has not appeared in my work at all. Although as Count Olaf's hygiene gets worse and worse, I may find occasion to use it. And then there is a somewhat obscure definition of the word lousy, meaning abundantly supplied, the way Count Olaf is lousy with treacherous plans, or the Queequeg is lousy with metal pipes, or the entire world is lousy with unfathomable secrets. And it is this definition that the Baudelaire orphans pondered, as they huddled with Fiona underneath the mysterious floor lamps of the Gorgonian grotto and watched more and more mushrooms sprout from the sand. As their surroundings became lousy with the medusoid mycelium, the children thought of all the other things in their lives with which they were abundantly supplied. The children's lives were lousy with mystery, from the mysteries of VFD to the mysteries of their own futures, with each mystery crowding the others like the stalks and caps of the poisonous fungi. Their lives were lousy with danger, from the dangers they had encountered above mountains and underneath buildings, to the dangers they had faced inside the city and out in the hinterlands, from the dangers of villainous people to the dangers of kind people who did not know any better. And their lives were lousy with lousiness, from terrible people to horrible meals, from terrifying locations to horrifying circumstances, and from dreadful inconveniences to inconvenient dreads, so that it seemed that their lives would always be lousy. Lousy with lousy days, and lousy with lousy nights, even if all of the lousy things with which their lives were lousy became less lousy, and less lousy with lousiness, over the lousy course of each lousy with lousiness moment, and with each new lousy mushroom, making the cave lousier and lousier with lousiness, it was almost too much for the Baudelaire orphans to bear.
"Lousy,"
Sunny said. "This is not good news," Klaus agreed. "Fiona, do you think we've been poisoned already?"
"No," Fiona said firmly. "The spores shouldn't reach us here, as long as we stay here at the far end of the cavern and the mushrooms don't advance any further. We should be safe."
"It looks like they've stopped advancing," Violet said, pointing at the line of grey mushrooms, and the volunteers saw that she was right. There were still new mushrooms popping up, but the fungus didn't seem to be getting any closer to the four children.
"I guess the mycelium has only grown that far," Fiona said. "We're very lucky."
"I don't feel very lucky," Klaus said. "I feel trapped. How will we get out of here?"
"There's only one way," Violet said. "The only path back to the Queequeg leads through those mushrooms."
"If we go through the mushrooms," Fiona said, "we'll most likely be poisoned. One spore could easily slip through our suits."
"Antidote?"
Sunny asked.
"I might find the recipe for a cure," Fiona replied, "someplace in my mycological library, but we don't want to take that chance. We'll have to exit another way."
For a moment, all four children looked up into the blackness of the passage above their heads. Violet frowned and put one hand on the damp and slippery tiles of the wall. With the other hand, she reached into the waterproof pocket of her uniform and drew out a ribbon to tie up her hair.
"Can we go out that way?"
Klaus asked. Can you invent something to help us climb up that passageway?
Chingibibob,
Sunny said, which meant there's plenty of materials here in the sand. Materials aren't the problem, Violet said, and peered up into the blackness. We're far below the surface of the water. It must be miles and miles to the surface. Even the best climbing device would wear out over the journey, and if it did, we'd fall all the way down. But someone must use that passageway, Klaus said. Otherwise it wouldn't have been built. It doesn't matter, Fiona said. We can't go out that way. We need to get to the Queequeg. Otherwise my stepfather will wonder what's become of us. Eventually he'd put on his diving helmet and go investigate. And the tide would carry him right into the poisonous fungus, Klaus finished. Fiona's right. Even if we could climb all the way up, it'd be the wrong way to go. But what else can we do? Violet said, her voice rising. We can't spend the rest of our lives in this miserable place. Fiona looked at the mushrooms and sighed. Mushroom Minutia said that this fungus waxes and wanes. Right now it's waxing. We'll have to wait until it wanes again, and then run quickly over the sand and swim back down to the submarine. But how long will it be until it starts waning? Klaus said. I don't know, Fiona admitted. It could be just a few minutes, or a few hours, could even be a few days. A few days? Violet said. In a few days, your stepfather will give up on us. In a few days, we'll miss the VFD gathering. We can't wait a few days. It's our only choice, Klaus said, putting a comforting hand on Violet's shoulder. We can wait until the mushrooms disappear, or we can find ourselves poisoned. That's not a choice at all, Violet replied bitterly. It's a Hobson's choice, Klaus said. Remember? The eldest Baudelaire looked down at her brother and gave him a small smile. Of course I remember, she said.
Mama-san,
Sunny said. Her siblings looked down at her, and Violet picked her up in her arms. Who's Hobson? Fiona asked. What was his choice? Klaus smiled. Thomas Hobson lived in Britain in the 17th century, he said. He was in charge of a stable, and according to legend, he always told his customers they had a choice. They could take the horse closest to the door, or no horse at all.
That's not really a choice, Fiona said.
Violet smiled.
Precisely, she said. A Hobson's choice is something that's not a choice at all. It's an expression our mother used to use. She'd say, I'll give you a Hobson's choice, Violet. You can clean your room, or I will stand in the doorway and sing your least favourite song over and over.
Fiona grinned.
What was your least favourite song?
She asked.
Row, row, row your boat, Violet said. I hate the part about life being but a dream.
She'd offer me the Hobson's choice of doing the dishes or reading the poetry of Edgar Guest, Klaus said. He's my absolute least favourite poet.
Bath or pink dress,
Sunny said.
Did your mother always joke around like that? Fiona asked. Mine used to get awfully mad if I didn't clean my room.
Our mother would get mad too, Klaus said. Remember, Violet, when we left the window of the library open and that night it rained?
She really flew off the handle, Violet said, using a phrase which here means became extremely angry. We spoiled an atlas that she said was irreplaceable.
You should have heard her yell, Klaus said. Our father came down from his study to see what was the matter.
And then he started yelling too, Violet said.
And the Baudelaires paused and looked at one another uncomfortably. Everyone yells, of course, from time to time, but the Baudelaire children did not like to think about their parents yelling, particularly now that they were no longer around to apologize or explain themselves. It is often difficult to admit that someone you love is not perfect, or to consider aspects of a person that are less than admirable. To the Baudelaires, it felt almost as if they had drawn a line
after their parents died, a secret line in their memories, separating all the wonderful things about the Baudelaire parents from the things that were perhaps not quite so wonderful. Since the fire, whenever they thought of their parents, the Baudelaires never stepped over this secret line, preferring to ponder the best moments the family had together rather than any of the times when they had fought or been unfair or selfish. But now, suddenly, in the gloom of the Gorgonian grotto, the siblings had stumbled across that line and found themselves thinking of that angry afternoon in the library, and in moments other angry afternoons and evenings had occurred to them until their brains were lousy with memories of all stripes, a phrase which here means both good and bad. It gave the siblings a queasy feeling to cross this line in their memories and admit that their parents were sometimes difficult, and it made them feel all the queasier to realize they could not step back and pretend they had never remembered these less than perfect moments, any more than they could step back in time and once again find themselves safe in the Baudelaire home before fire and Count Olaf had appeared in their lives. "My brother used to get angry too," Fiona said. "Before he disappeared, he would have awful fights with my stepfather, late at night when they thought I was asleep."
"Your stepfather didn't mention that," Violet said. "He said your brother was a charming man."
"Maybe he only remembers the charming parts," Fiona replied. "Maybe he doesn't want to remember everything. Maybe he wants to keep those parts secret."
"Do you think your stepfather knew about this place?" Klaus asked, looking around the eerie room. "He mentioned that we might find a place to take off our diving helmets, remember? It seemed strange at the time."
"I don't know," Fiona said. "Maybe that's another secret he was keeping."
"Like the sugar bowl," Violet said.
"Speaking which," Sunny said.
"Sunny's right," Klaus said. "We should keep looking for the sugar bowl."
"It must be here someplace," Fiona agreed. "And besides, we need some way to pass the time until the fungus wanes. Everyone should spread out and give a shout if you find the sugar bowl."
The Baudelaires nodded in agreement, and the four volunteers took distant positions on the sand, taking care not to step any closer to the medusoid mycelium. For the next few hours, they dug through the sand floor of the grotto and examined what they found by the light of the two floor lamps. Each layer of sand uncovered several items of interest, but no matter how many objects the children encountered, no one gave a shout. Violet found a butter dish, a length of electrical wire, and an odd square stone with messages carved in three languages, but not what she was looking for. And so the eldest Baudelaire remained silent. Klaus found a box of toothpicks, a small hand puppet, and a ring made of dull metal, but not what he had come to the cave to find. And so the middle Baudelaire merely sighed. And Sunny found two cloth napkins, a broken telephone receiver, and a fancy wine glass filled with holes. But when she finally opened her mouth to speak, the youngest Baudelaire merely said,
"Snack!"
which meant something like, "Why don't we stop for a bite to eat?" and quickly opened the crackers and peanut butter she had found.
"Thanks, Sunny,"
Fiona said, taking a cracker spread with peanut butter.
"I must say, Baudelaires, I'm getting frustrated. My hands ache from all that digging, but there's no sign of the sugar bowl."
"I'm beginning to think this is a fool's errand," Violet said, using a phrase which here means errand performed by a fool.
"We journeyed all the way down here to find a crucial item, and instead it seemed like we're finding nothing but junk. It's a waste of time."
"Not necessarily," Klaus said, eating a cracker and looking at the items he had found. "We may not have found the sugar bowl, but I think we did find some crucial information."
"What do you mean?"
Violet said. "Look at this," Klaus said, and held up a book he had taken from the sand.
"It's a collection of poetry, and most of it is too damp to read, but look at the title page."
The middle Baudelaire held open the book, so the other volunteers could see. Verst, furtive, disclosure, Violet read out loud.
VFD,
Sunny said. Yes, Klaus said. Furtive means secretive, and disclosure means to reveal something. I think VFD may have hidden things here, not just the sugar bowl, but other secrets. Well, that would make sense, Violet said. This grotto is a bit like a secret passageway, like the one we found underneath our home, or the one Quigley found underneath his. Fiona nodded and began to search through a pile of items she had taken from the sand. I found an envelope earlier, she said, but I didn't think to open it. I was too busy concentrating on the sugar bowl.
Punctilio,
Sunny said, holding up a torn and tattered sheet of newspaper. The children could see the letters VFD circled in a headline. I'm too exhausted to dig any more, Violet said. Let's spend some time reading instead. Klaus, you can examine that poetry book. Fiona, you can see if there's anything worthwhile in that envelope. And I'll take a look at the clipping Sunny found.
Me?
Asked Sunny, whose reading skills were still developing. Why don't you cook us something, Sunny? Klaus suggested with a smile. Those crackers just whetted my appetite.
Pronto,
the youngest Baudelaire promised, looking at the foodstuffs she had found in the sand, most of which were sealed up tight. The phrase, whet my appetite, as you probably know, refers to one's hunger being awakened, and it usually refers to food. The Baudelaires had lost track of time while searching through the sand of the grotto, and the snack Sunny prepared made them realize just how long it had been since they had eaten. But another appetite had been whetted for the Baudelaires as well, a hunger for secrets and for information that might help them. As Sunny began to prepare a meal for her fellow volunteers, Violet and Klaus looked over the materials they had found, devouring whatever information seemed important, and Fiona did the same thing, leaning up against the tiled wall of the cavern as she examined the contents of the envelope she had found. The volunteers' hunger for information was almost as fierce as their hunger for food, and after a lengthy period of studying and note-taking, whisking and mixing, the four children could not say whether they were more eager to hear about the others' research or to eat the meal Sunny had prepared. "What is this?" Violet asked her sister, peering into the fish bowl Sunny was using as a serving dish.
"Pesto lo mein," Sunny explained.
"What my sister means," Klaus said, "is that she found a package of soft Chinese noodles which she tossed with an Italian basil sauce she got out of a jar."
"That's quite an international combination," Fiona said.
"Hobson,"
Sunny said, which meant I didn't have much choice given our surroundings, and then held up another item she had found.
"Wasabi?"
"What's wasabi?" Violet asked.
"It's a Japanese condiment," Klaus said. "It's very spicy and often served with fish." "Why don't we save the wasabi, Sunny?" Violet said, taking the tin of wasabi and putting it in the pocket of her uniform. "We'll take it back to the Queequeg, and you can use it in a seafood recipe." Sunny nodded in agreement and passed the fish bowl to her siblings.
"Utensi,"
she said. "We can use these swizzle sticks as chopsticks," Klaus said. "We'll have to take turns, and whoever isn't eating can tell us what they've discovered. Here, Fiona, why don't you go first?"
"Thanks,"
Fiona said, taking the swizzle sticks gratefully. "I'm quite hungry. Did you learn anything from that poetry book?" "Not as much as I would have liked," Klaus said. "Most of the pages were soaked from their journey, and so I couldn't read much. But I believe I've learned a new code. Verse, fluctuation, declaration. It's a way to communicate by substituting words in poems."
"I don't understand," Violet said.
"It's a bit tricky," Klaus said, opening his commonplace book, in which he'd copied the information. "The book uses a poem called My Last Duchess by Robert Browning as an example."
"I've read that," Fiona said,
twirling a few noodles around a swizzle stick to get them into her mouth.
It's a very creepy story about a man who murders his wife.
Right, Klaus said. But if a volunteer used the name of a poem in a coded communication, the title might be My Last Wife instead of My Last Duchess, by the poet Obert Browning instead of Robert Browning.
What purpose would that serve? Violet said.
The volunteer reading it would notice the mistake, Klaus said. The changing of certain words or letters is a kind of fluctuation. If you fixed the fluctuations in the poem, you'd receive the message.
Duchess R? Fiona asked. What kind of message is that?
I'm not sure, Klaus admitted. The next page in the book is missing.
Do you think the missing page is a code, too? Violet asked.
Klaus shrugged. I don't know, he said. Codes are nothing more than a way of talking so that some people understand and other people don't. Remember when we talked to Quigley in the cave, with all the other Snow Scouts listening?
Yes,
Violet said. We used words that began with V, F and D so that we knew we were all on the same side.
Maybe we should have a code ourselves, Fiona said, so that we can communicate if we run into trouble.
That's a good idea, Klaus said. What should we use as code words?
Food,
Sunny suggested.
Perfect, Violet said.
We'll draw up a list of foods and what they mean in our code. We'll bring them up in conversation, and our enemies will never suspect that we're actually communicating.
And our enemies could be around any corner, Fiona said,
handing the fishbowl of low mein to Violet and picking up the envelope she had found.
Inside this envelope was a letter. Normally I don't like to read other people's mail, but it seems unlikely that this letter will ever reach Gregor Anwissel.
Gregor Anwissel? Violet asked.
He's the man who founded the research centre. Who was writing to him?
A woman named Kit, Fiona said. I think it's Kit Snicket, Jacques' sister.
Of course, Klaus said.
Your stepfather said she was a noble woman who helped build the Queequeg.
According to her letter, Fiona said, Gregor Anwissel was involved in something called a schism.
What's that?
It was a big conflict within VFD, Klaus said. Quigley told us a little bit about it.
Everybody chose sides,
Violet recalled.
And now the organization is in chaos. Which side was Gregor on?
I don't know, Fiona said, frowning.
Some of this letter is in code, and some of it was in water. I can't understand all of it, but it sounds like Gregor was involved with something called volatile fungus deportation.
Volatile means unstable or likely to cause trouble, Klaus said. Fungus, of course, means mushrooms, and deportation means moving something from one place to another.
Who was moving unstable mushrooms?
VFD, Fiona replied.
During the schism, Gregor thought the medusoid mycelium might be useful.
The medusoid mycelium? Violet said,
looking nervously at the silent grey mushrooms that still lined the entrance to the small tiled room, their black splotches looking particularly eerie in the dim light.
I can't imagine thinking that such deadly things could be useful.
Listen to what Kit wrote about it, Fiona said.
The poisonous fungus you insist on cultivating in the grotto will bring grim consequences for all of us. Our factory at Lousy Lane can provide some dilution of the mycelium's destructive respiratory capabilities, and you assure me that the mycelium grows best in small enclosed spaces, but this is of little comfort. One mistake, Gregor, and your entire facility would have to be abandoned. Please, do not become the thing you dread most by adopting the destructive tactic of our most villainous enemies, playing with fire.
Klaus was busily copying Kit Snicket's letter into his commonplace book. Gregor was growing those mushrooms, he said, to use on enemies of VFD. He was going to poison people? Violet asked.
Villainous people, Fiona replied. But Kit Snicket thought that using poisonous mushrooms was equally villainous. They were working on a way to weaken the poison in a factory on Lousy Lane, but the writer of this letter still thought that volatile fungus deportation was too dangerous, and she warned Gregor that if he wasn't careful, the mycelium would poison the entire research centre.
And now the centre is gone, Violet said, and the mycelium remains. Something went very wrong, right here where we're sitting. I still don't understand it, Klaus said. Was Gregor a villain?
I think he was volatile, Fiona said, like the medusoid mycelium. And the writer of this letter says that if you cultivate something volatile, then you're playing with fire.
Violet shuddered, stopped eating her pesto lo mein, and put down the fishbowl. Playing with fire, of course, is an expression that refers to any dangerous or risky activity, such as writing a letter to a volatile person, or journeying through a dark cave filled with a poisonous fungus in order to search for an object that was taken away quite some time before, and the Baudelaires did not like to think about the fire they were playing with, or the fires that had already been played with, in this damp and mysterious room. For a moment, nobody spoke, and the Baudelaires gazed at the stalks and caps of the deadly mushrooms, wondering what had gone wrong with Anwissel Aquatics. They wondered how the schism began, and they wondered about all the mysterious and villainous things that seemed to surround the three orphans, drawing closer and closer as their woeful lives went on, and if such mysteries would ever be solved, and if such villains ever defeated.
Wayne,
Sunny said suddenly, and the children saw it was true. The crowd of mushrooms seemed to be just a bit smaller, and here and there they saw a stalk and cap disappear back into the sand, as if the poisonous fungus had decided to implement an alternate strategy, a phrase which here means would terrorize the Baudelaires in another way. Sunny's right, Klaus said with relief. The medusoid mycelium is waning. Soon it'll be safe enough to return to the Queequeg.
It must be a fairly short cycle,
Fiona said, making a note in her commonplace book.
How long do you think we've been here?
All night, at least, Violet said, unfolding the sheet of newspaper Sunny had found. It's lucky we found all these materials, otherwise we would have been quite bored.
My brother always had a deck of cards with him, Fiona remembered, in case he was stuck in a boring situation. He invented this card game called Fernald's Folly, and we used to play it together whenever we had a long wait.
Fernald? Violet asked. Was that your brother's name?
Yes,
Fiona said.
Why'd you ask?
I was just curious, she said, hurriedly tucking the newspaper into the pocket of her uniform. There was just enough room to slip it next to the tin of wasabi. Aren't you going to tell us what was in the newspaper? Klaus asked. I saw the headline said VFD.
I didn't learn anything, Violet said.
The article was too blurred to read. Sunny said, and gave her sister a sly look. The youngest Baudelaire had known Violet since she was born, of course, and found it quite easy to tell when she was lying. Violet looked back at Sunny, and then at Klaus, and shook her head very, very slightly.
Why don't we get ready to go? The eldest Baudelaire suggested. By the time we pack up these documents and put on our diving helmets, the fungus will have waned completely.
You're right, Fiona said. Here, Sunny, I'll help you get into your helmet. It's the least I can do after you cooked such a delicious meal.
Chivalrush,
Sunny said, which meant, that's very kind of you. And although Fiona had not known Sunny very long, she understood what the youngest Baudelaire had said, more or less, and smiled at all three of the Baudelaire siblings. As the four volunteers suited up, a phrase which here means prepared their helmets for an underwater journey, the Baudelaire children felt as if Fiona fit them like a glove, as a friend, or possibly something more. It felt as if Fiona and the Baudelaires were part of the same team, or the same organization, trying to solve the same mysteries and defeat the same villains. It felt that way to the two younger Baudelaires, anyway. Only Violet felt as if their friendship were more volatile, as if Fiona fit her like the wrong glove, or as if their friendship had a tiny flaw, a flaw that might turn into a schism. As Violet put the diving helmet over her head and made sure that the zipper of the uniform was zipped tight over the portrait of Herman Melville, she heard the slight rustle of the newspaper clipping in her pocket and frowned. She kept frowning as the last of the mushrooms disappeared into the sand, and the four children stepped carefully back into the icy, dark water. Because they were travelling against the tide, the volunteers had decided to hold hands, so they would not lose track of one another as they returned to the Queequeg. And as their dark journey began, Violet thought of the dangerous and risky secret concealed in her pocket, and realized, as Klaus led the way back to the submarine, with Fiona holding Klaus's hand, and Violet holding Fiona's, and Sunny curled in her helmet, tucked tightly under Violet's arm, that even while swimming in the icy depths of the ocean, the Baudelaires were playing with fire. The sinister information in the newspaper clipping was like a tiny spore, blossoming in the small enclosed space of Violet's pocket, like a spore of the deadly medusoid mycelium, which at that very moment was blossoming in the small enclosed space of a diving helmet worn by one of the Baudelaire orphans.